Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, it's Rachel. Alex Wagner has a brand new show here on MSNBC. It's called Alex Wagner Tonight. Take a listen and then go subscribe to Alex Wagner Tonight, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, a judge in Florida says he will likely release a redacted version of the FBI affidavit behind the search of Donald Trump's Florida country club home. New York Times Justice Department reporter Katie Benner joins us live. And in a New York courtroom, Trump's longtime top executive pleads guilty, admitting he conspired with the former president's company to not pay taxes. And now he will testify against the Trump organization. Sue Craig, the New York Times reporter who has led the reporting on Trump's finances, is here in studio tonight. And he is the member of the Biden cabinet dispatched to take the president's case to Republicans and Fox News. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg joins us live. But first, we start in September of 2015. Donald Trump was 3 months removed from his famed escalator ride announcing his presidential bid. He'd already risen to the top of the Republican field, leading in all the polls, and he found himself showing off his Trump Tower office to the Wall Street Journal.
This is Shaquille O'Neal's shoe.
Oh, my God.
Right here, which is a serious
shoe. Is that
shoe.
A real
That's
shoe?
That's a real shoe. He took it off after a game and handed it
oh
to
me. Oh, my God.
I carried it like this. Tom Brady's Super Bowl helmet.
Wow.
This is Mike Tyson's belt.
Shaq's shoe. Tom Brady's Super Bowl helmet. Mike Tyson's belt. We have known for a while that Donald Trump likes to collect memorabilia, if you will. And so when Trump arrived at the White House, well, it was no different. Here is the New York Times today describing Trump's time in office. Quote, White House aides described how excited Trump was to show off all the material he had access to, including letters from the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which he routinely waved at visitors, alarming his advisors. Some of those letters were among the trove that Mr. Trump had with him at Mar-a-Lago. So is that why federal agents retrieved over 25 boxes of documents from Trump's Florida home last week? Did he just want to show off his 11 sets of classified papers to friends and guests? Papers that the FBI took last week? Hey, guys, look. This one's marked classified. That one over there, it's marked top secret. Check it out. Sure, maybe. Or it could be something more nefarious. Because if that more innocent explanation is true, then why has Trump not answered the single most important question of this entire saga? Why didn't he just give the documents back when the government asked for them, before a search warrant was even approved? Why not simply hand them over? I mean, Trump has been anything but quiet when it comes to literally everything else related to the FBI search of his Palm Beach home. He was the one that first told all of us that the FBI was, quote, raiding his home, breaking into his safe, taking his passports, several of them. Trump has even argued that the whole search warrant should be released. Let us not forget that the FBI did, in fact, retrieve 11 sets of classified documents as part of that search, including some documents labeled top secret. We learned yesterday that federal agents are still sifting through all those documents more than a week after the search. And today, in a federal courtroom in West Palm Beach, a federal magistrate judge held a hearing on whether or not to grant the request of several media organizations, including our own, NBC News, to unseal the FBI's sworn affidavit that served as the basis for the judge to sign off on that search warrant. And that affidavit is where all the, forgive me for this, that's where all the juicy information exists. That document is the roadmap, to borrow the government's own description, laid out by an FBI agent as to why the government thought there was probable cause to believe evidence of crimes, plural, could be found at Mar-a-Lago. The Justice Department told that federal judge earlier this week that releasing the affidavit, the one currently under seal, would harm the department's ongoing criminal investigation. Because, again, that is where all the juicy stuff is. In court today, arguing for the DOJ was the head of the Justice Department's Counterintelligence Division. And interestingly enough, Trump's lawyer, Yes, the former CrossFit attorney and One America news anchor, Christina Bob. She did attend, but she just watched. Christina Bob did not argue on behalf of her client, the former president. I mean, this was a hearing about something he is apparently incensed about, and yet Donald Trump did not want an argument to be made on his behalf, which is interesting. Here is NBC's report from inside the courtroom. Quote, a top counterintelligence and national security official argued the detailed and reasonably lengthy document needed to be kept completely under wraps because it contains substantial grand jury information in a unique case with national security overtones. He also said the government is very concerned about the safety of the witnesses in the case whose identities could become compromised if the affidavit is unsealed. The government lawyer pointed to amateur sleuths on the internet who could maybe find personal information. This is a volatile situation with respect to this particular search across this political spectrum, he said, and with one side in particular. The Justice Department also made the case that the criminal investigation is in its, quote, early stages. But despite the Justice Department's objections, the judge ruled that it was, quote, very important that the public have as much information as it possibly can about the search. The government, the judge said, had not met its burden of showing that the entire affidavit should remain sealed. Instead, he ordered the Justice Department to submit a proposed redacted version by next Thursday at noon. He also ordered some other documents from the warrant to be unsealed. These documents do not include anything particularly revolutionary, but I do want to point out something that's in one of them. One of those documents is dated August 5th, and it is the government's motion asking the judge to allow the DOJ to file the Mar-a-Lago search warrant under seal. And the department gave an explanation as to why they wanted the search warrant to be kept secret from the public. Making their argument, the Justice Department writes, quote, the United States submits that there is good cause because the integrity of the ongoing investigation might be compromised and evidence might be destroyed. It is not a surprise for the government to think that evidence might be destroyed if the existence of the search warrant got out before they executed it. But to see that in simple black and white text about a former president is just astonishing. It is against that backdrop that it does look like we will see at least some version of this FBI affidavit where all the juicy stuff is as soon as next Thursday. Joining us now is Katie Benner, Justice Department reporter for The New York Times, who is covering this story and who has also landed several major scoops related to the investigation into January 6th. Katie Benner, thank you for making the time to come into the studio and join me tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start first with the curious behavior of Christina Bob, who's representing the former president in all of this. Do you think there's a reason why she did not actually choose to speak in the courtroom today? It's sort of maybe one could draw the inference that Trump doesn't actually want this affidavit unsealed. What did you make of it?
Well, I'm not really sure what Trump's motivation is or what her motivation is, but I think that we've seen through his presidency and post-presidency that his most powerful statements come on social media, before cameras. He does much better in those venues than he does in a court of law.
Well, I mean, he has made quite a bit of hay, if you will, over all of this. So the mere fact that he's not saying anything to prove his case in court is kind of interesting in the context of all of this. But I got to say, throughout all of this, Trump has, you know, created a lot of smoke that he himself could have cleared if he wanted to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is the question about why Donald Trump just simply hasn't explained why he hasn't given those government papers back.
So it's so interesting you say this, because if you look at his behavior during the Russia investigation, he really played against the fact that he knew that Robert Mueller was never going to say anything. And he was able to really use that to his advantage. And you saw him kind of doing the same thing in the beginning of the revelations about this investigation.
Yeah.
He assumed that Attorney General Merrick Garland would be, much like Mueller, completely silent, and he would be able to fill that void completely. But the Justice Department, interestingly, has found ways to fill the narrative void itself without compromising sources and methods, without speaking directly about the investigation, without saying anything particular about Donald Trump. And I think that you're seeing a recalibration happen in terms of how Trump and his supporters are going to respond.
Right, because I think Trump's learned behavior from the Mueller investigation was poke the bear, poke the bear, poke the bear, nothing's going to happen. And Merrick Garland is having a press, had a press conference shortly after Trump made the released the information about the raid, the seizure, whatever we're calling it at present, and basically called Trump's bluff a little bit, right?
Absolutely.
What's emerged in all of this, as you talk about the recalibration, is how deadly serious the Department of Justice is about following up on some of Trump's claims, right? Rolling Stone is reporting tonight that two people familiar with the matter tell Rolling Stone that the FBI has begun asking former Trump administration officials whether they've heard of the so-called standing order Trump claims to have given. In recent days, the sources say the feds have sent interview requests to the ex-officials, including former NSC personnel. The standing order is the standing order to declassify material, which is Trump's kind of excuse for all of this and why he took the documents. I had a standing order to declassify. You know, in previous times, nobody might have followed up on that. But here's the DOJ calling people who were on the NSC and saying, hey, do you know anything about this?
Right.
How do you think that affects the sort of mindset inside Trump land? And what is the meaningful impact on that in terms of this investigation?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing Donald Trump kind of run up against the fact that he no longer controls the Justice Department and that these are not his appointees anymore. So they're actually just taking incredibly normal investigative steps, the kind of steps that prosecutors would take if presented with a claim. When they were investigating somebody, they would want to make sure it was true. They would try to vet it. That's not unusual. It seems unusual because of the way that Trump has been treated in the past, or because of the perception of his power and invincibility. But what's truly unusual is that all of these things are happening. These questions are being asked of a former president.
Yeah. I mean, and then there is a simple question, Katie, of why Trump took them, right? I mean, we don't know why he won't give them back. We're not exactly sure why he took them in the first place. But Maggie Haberman, your colleague at the New York Times, had an interesting, I will call it like theorizing, well-educated theorizing. We played that footage of Donald Trump with Shaquille O'Neal's shoe because he likes memorabilia, right? He likes taking things. But she has an intriguing point that she makes in the article today and says, Mr. Trump repeatedly had material sent up to the White House residence, and it was not always clear what happened to it. He sometimes asked to keep material after his intelligence briefings, but aides said he was so uninterested in the paperwork during the briefings themselves that they never understood what he wanted it for. How do you read that, Katie? What could that mean? There's like a lot that you could read between the lines there. And I want to know how you interpret that data point.
You know, I think that it's another way of saying that Donald Trump was not a typical White House official. He was not a typical president. And so the reasons for which somebody would want classified, top secret, or sensitive information may not apply here. He not only loved trophies, but he loved anything that had to do with his business interests, that had to do with his personal interests or his personal grievances. And so you can imagine in the course of being presented with something like the presidential daily brief, you could see information like that kind of come to him, and it catches attention almost like a bird seeing something very shiny.
Yeah, I mean, and a bit craven, too, to not actually be interested in it in terms of how it affects his running of the country, but how it might benefit him personally down the line. I do want to ask, as we're all talking about Mar-a-Lago consistently, are we taking our eyes off the ball in terms of the January 6th investigation? Because Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee at the January 6th committee in Congress, is saying they are having daily depositions, that nearly all of Trump's cabinet has been cooperative and willing to talk to the committee. I mean, what can you tell us about the sort of momentum over there and the DOJ's investigation, which seems to be catching up with the committee's work?
Sure. You know, I wouldn't say that we're paying too much attention to Mar-a-Lago because it's such an historically bizarre and strange and momentous thing to happen for a former president's residence to be searched by warrant by the Justice Department. I don't think that we will keep our eyes off the January 6th committee for too long, particularly because Liz Cheney just lost her election and she's going to fight to stay in the public spotlight as she decides whether or not to run for president. And the microphone that she has is the committee. The committee, to your point, has been having these interviews and depositions every day, and they're gathering more and more material. And you can expect that when that next set of hearings comes around, it's going to be as explosive as the committee can make it.
Well, and instead of losing the cooperation of former Trump aides, they're gaining it. Interesting developments all around. Katie Benner, the New York Times Justice Department reporter with the New York Times. Katie, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, the other courtroom that Donald Trump was focused on today, the one in New York, where his longtime executive pleaded guilty to working with Trump's company to rip off the government in a tax scheme. And then said that, yes, he will testify against the Trump Organization. New York Times investigative reporter Suzanne Craig joins us here next. And Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg joins us live to talk about his one-man campaign on the right-wing airwaves. We'll be right back.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
Once the hearing started, there were no cameras allowed, but thanks to the dutiful work of courtroom stenographers, we do have some idea of how it went down. Here was just one of the charges. The judge, Mr. Weisselberg, it is alleged that you, together with the Trump Corporation, engaged in a scheme constituting a systematic ongoing course of conduct with intent to defraud more than one person and to obtain property from more than one person by false and fraudulent pretenses, representations, and promises, and so obtain property with a value in excess of $1,000 from one or more such persons, specifically the United States Internal Revenue Service, the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance, and the New York City Department of Finance. Is that true? The defendant. Yes, Your Honor. Donald Trump's longest-serving employee, Alan Weisselberg, walked into a New York courtroom today and pleaded guilty again and again and again to committing fraud together with the Trump Corporation. The judge literally used the phrase "together with the Trump Corporation" over and over today while reading the charges against Alan Weisselberg. Weisselberg ended up pleading guilty to 15 felonies, 15, all relating to fraud and tax evasion that occurred at the former president's business. He's set to serve anywhere between 100 days and 5 months in prison at New York's notorious jail on Rikers Island. A lot of the media attention on this case is focused on the fact that Alan Weisselberg did not agree to testify against Trump himself as part of his plea agreement with the government. But Weisselberg did agree to testify against the Trump Organization. And that is important because it means that prosecutors will get to ask Alan Weisselberg about the crimes he committed at the Trump Organization. They will be able to ask him under oath who are the others involved in the criminal conspiracy that Weisselberg has just pleaded guilty to taking part in. And we do know that there are only a handful of people who could have been involved in that conspiracy because countless reports over the past few years have revealed that the Trump Organization isn't a place where decisions are made without sign-off from someone with the last name Trump. One of the reporters who has done some of the most extensive and detailed reporting on Trump's business and his finances is Suzanne Craig. Suzanne Craig was part of the team of the New York Times reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize for their in-depth reporting on Trump's finances. That dogged reporting definitively exploded the myth that Donald Trump was a self-made billionaire, and it revealed that Trump's organization was built on a foundation of squandered inheritance and tax dodging. She is exactly the person I want to talk to today. Suzanne Craig, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
So let's just first start with the sort of thing everybody's trying to parse today, which is how meaningful is the difference between testifying against the Trump Organization and testifying against Trump? It seems to be meaningful enough that this is like the whole thing Alan Weisselberg's deal is predicated on.
No, it's pretty meaningful, but people are saying, well, how can he do that and not testify against Trump? You know, Donald Trump, I've covered him for a number of years, his finances. He up until the time he was in the White House, he was still signing every check. Like, he is so intertwined that how can testifying against the Trump Organization not be testifying against Donald Trump? We're not really going to know how that goes until October if it does go to trial and it doesn't settle. I imagine what it's going to go is Donald Trump was all for these perks and, you know, said, take a car and you can have one for your wife. These are some of the things that Alan Weiselberg was accused and pleaded in court today about doing. But did Donald Trump know is the question. Maybe Donald Trump said, do this and assumed that the taxes were going to be paid on them, because all of these things are fine to get for employees. But the problem is when they're not reported to the IRS as compensation. So I think that if I'm imagining how that's going to go, it's going to be a case of he didn't know. And there's no paper trail that probably shows that he did know.
I mean, that would seem to be the suggestion by the mere fact that Alan Weiselberg accepted this deal or created this deal.
It seems hard to believe. But in order to bring a case against Donald Trump, you have to show the criminal intent. And if he's not willing to testify and say the boss knew, then he is going to say, you know, it's kind of an I alone did it. And there may be a few other people that he mentions, but he's going to say I was responsible and it was my fault. And then that's going to hit the Trump organization pretty hard if it goes to trial and a jury is going to hear that. But that's sort of where I kind of see it coming down if it goes to trial in October.
What of the Trump organization? I mean, how secure is its financial position at this point? Can it weather this next chapter?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, from what we've seen in their taxes, and that was up until 2008, most of their businesses do not make money. And they've had some hard years since then. They've had COVID. And January 6th, a number of businesses walked away for them. One of Donald Trump's big money makers heading into the White House was these one-off licensing deals where he would get a couple million here and there to put his name on a hotel. All those things, you know, have hurt them. And in addition, we've seen them sell at least one really big asset, which was one of his crown jewels, the old post office.
Yeah.
I don't think people do that unless they need money. And he did that. So we don't quite know exactly how much cash they are sitting on. But these things hurt. You know, he's potentially in New York State looking at a civil fine that could be substantial, you know, tens of millions. It could go up into the high, close to 100. We don't know. That fine, whatever he's facing there, whether he goes to trial, if he is hit with a fine, that's not tax deductible. He's looking at us, you know, when you go to court in the criminal case, they're not going to put an individual in jail because it's a corporation. That's going to be another fine. Mm-hmm. It could be substantial. He's going to start writing some potentially big checks if these things, you know, don't go his way.
And he's in the habit of having other people write checks for him, right? Like the RNC is paying all of his legal bills. Now it's time that Donald Trump may, in fact, have to pony up himself.
Yeah, and you're going to, I think, see, you know, you could see additional headlines where potentially more assets are sold as this continues to go. Not just the fines are adding up, but the businesses, you know, historically, they're not making money. And he's got a few things that make money and that helps him out. But, you know, this is not sort of a great news headline for them.
You reported back in 2020 about Trump's audits. I mean, he was always saying, I can't release my tax returns because I'm under audit. Is he still under audit?
He was under audit. We don't know if he still is, but that audit is very serious. And if it goes against him, we don't know the outcome. If there has been one, that's a potentially another $100 million+ that he's going to have to repay the IRS. There's a lot of things brewing in the background financially that are problematic. And you see you pop up. He doesn't talk about his businesses very often. Occasionally it pops up. For example, he hosted the LIV golf tournament, very controversial. I'm sure that brought in a lot of money. So there are things coming in. They're one off that you see he's out there and he's, you know, some money's coming in. But there's a lot of storm clouds out there for his finances.
Well, and if he's convicted of anything on the other legal fronts, then all of his lenders can call in their debts, too.
We don't know the covenants of the loan, but that's something called collateral damage. And a lot of loans have terms in there. We don't know if his do, but they say if you're convicted immediately, you have to pay the money back. So that's another thing that's potentially hanging over them. And we don't know if the loans that he has specifically have that covenant. But that's another thing that's weighing on them. Most do, so they might.
One would think that actually the money problems are the thing that is probably most deeply affecting him right now, or the threat of money problems. But I got to ask you, as someone who's followed the sort of ins and outs, the trials and tribulations of the Trump organization and its associated consigliaries, Alan Weiselberg is going to Rikers Island, right? Rikers, this week, a doctor was found dead in Rikers Island, like killed in the jail, the correction department captain stabbed in the neck at the Rikers Island complex. This is not club fed. This is not a cushy.
No, that's on the one end. And then you've just got to think COVID, you know,
right.
I mean, it's just there's a lot of serious.
Are you surprised that he's going to jail for Trump effectively?
I think it's a pretty good deal for him. I think only, you know, when I think about sort of the calculation he made, did he want to go to trial and face that and just have it continue to linger? Or could he get this deal? And then with good behavior, he'll be out in 100 days and he's going to have probably a lot of protection inside. I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of soul searching that went down on this. But, you know, I guess I'm more just surprised we're at this juncture than I am that he's going to
yes,
jail.
That is probably the reasonable.
I wake up and I really shouldn't be surprised at anything,
no.
But, you know, it gives me some energy.
Yes. Well, when Sue Craig is surprised, we should all be surprised. Thank you so much for joining me
Thank
on set.
And congratulations, by the way, on the new show. It's been great this week, especially last night was just fabulous.
Thank you so much. That means a lot.
Yeah.
Suzanne Craig, investigative reporter for The New York Times. Thank you again for your time, energies, and reporting. Still to come here tonight, as the Biden administration celebrates a big win with the Inflation Reduction Act becoming law, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg joins us live to talk about the biggest investment this country has ever made in fighting climate change and how he's going to sell it to the GOP. Okay, Mayor Pete.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Roads are dying of old age. And come every spring, the bottoms drop out.
Yep, you have to be careful driving the kids over these roads.
What's a citizen gonna do?
That was a clip from a genuine film that General Motors made in 1954. It was called Give Yourself the Green Light, and it was Hollywood quality propaganda about highways. It framed traffic as a national crisis that was destroying the American dream.
Made 5 o'clock, kindly paid for. So you get a little home in the suburbs, away from the city smoke. Out from the shadows of the factory, into the sun and clean air. Raise a few kids, some flowers and vegetables. The big dream coming true. But it backfires into a pipe dream. Exhaust pipe dream. Every night it takes longer to get home, wasting more time and gasoline. No wonder everybody's acting so nervous. What's a citizen gonna do?
What can a citizen do?
To help find out, a Better Highways contest was recently conducted. Purpose? Arouse nationwide thinking on how to plan and pay for the safe and adequate highways we need.
As insane as this movie was, General Motors was not alone in making films like these. Ford made them, Dow Chemical made them. Basically, every company that sold cars or asphalt or tires turned themselves into production companies and made movies in the 1950s, movies selling Americans on the concept of highways. The reason was the Federal Highway Aid Act of 1956. Companies were either pushing for that $51 billion bill to pass, or they were trying to convince Americans to let them build highways through their neighborhoods once the bill did pass. And it worked. The bill passed. The legislation built 41,000 miles of new highway. Now, there's no doubt that the implementation of our country's new highway system was very often flawed, particularly since it often divided communities, especially those of color. But it became the largest public works project in the nation's history. It completely changed America. And now, today, with last year's Bipartisan Infrastructure Act and this week's Inflation Reduction Act, the Biden administration is attempting the biggest infrastructure transformation our country has seen since that act in 1956. Those pieces of legislation actually aim to correct some of the very real problems that the initial highway system imposed. The pollution, the carbon emissions, the destruction of primarily Black and brown communities. The goals of this law are ambitious. They fund a national network of electric vehicle charging stations and encourage Americans to switch over to electric cars with tax credits. The laws try to make public transit good enough to convince Americans to maybe even get out of those cars that they sit in. Taken together, all of this could be another major shift for this country, but it is one that is going to have to be sold to the American public. And unlike in the 1950s, no mega corporations are pumping out well-produced films to help convince Americans that environmentally sustainable transit is a worthwhile investment. This time around, one of the main salesmen for this hugely transformational part of the Biden administration's agenda is Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. Secretary Buttigieg has made a name for himself as one of the most effective communicators in the president's cabinet. Someone who's become known for his willingness and also his ability to speak to those across the political divide. But this time, he really has his work cut out for him. Because attacking this part of Biden's agenda is the conservative media's bread and butter.
Let's start right at the top. Pete's highway to hell. That's the focus of tonight's angle.
And Mayor Pete is pushing electric cars on struggling Americans.
In November, he told Americans in rural areas, the poorest parts of this country, to go ahead and buy electric vehicles. Get a Prius, even though they cost more than 50 grand. And that same month, of course, he reminded us that our highways are racist. More recently, the transportation secretary has been telling us about the one thing that's going to fix our high fuel prices and clogged commercial airline travel. And that's, of course, abortion.
Like I said, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg has his work cut out for him. He joins us live coming up next.
This is Pete Buttigieg, Biden's transportation secretary, seemingly out of touch with what it takes to own an electric vehicle in this country. Listen.
I'm still astonished that some folks, and I felt this, I was testifying in Congress yesterday, some folks seem to really struggle to let go of the status quo.
Struggle to let go of the status quo. Astonished that there isn't a bigger transition to EVs. You can put it up on the screen. The average cost of an electric vehicle in the United States today, Senator, we wrote it out, didn't round down or up. That is it. $66,997 for a new EV.
That was Fox News the day after Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg testified before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee last month. If that Fox News host had listened to what Secretary Buttigieg had said in that hearing, she would know that he had already offered a counterpoint. You can buy a brand new, fully electric Chevy Bolt for $25,600 right now. And that doesn't even take into account how the Biden administration's new electric vehicle tax credits can be applied in the purchase of used cars. So, how does the Biden administration get past the relentless accusations and alarmism from the right? The man with that answer is joining us now. Pete Buttigieg, President Biden's Secretary of Transportation. Secretary, Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for sharing that footage from the 50s. That's fascinating.
Well, we're fascinated by what has happened in America and what is coming to pass. But I got to ask you, because you've been kind of like the one-man band, or at least the loudest and most effective one-man band, in talking to the right, which has been highly resistant to renewables and electric vehicles. Do you think you are going to be able to convince the viewers of Fox News that what is happening here, what the Biden administration would like to do, and indeed what the country must do in this century, is move towards renewables? Do you think anyone is listening to the message that you have been offering on Fox News?
I think so. Look, obviously you have a political apparatus, an opinion apparatus of commentators, politicians, trying to keep everything the same, trying to keep electric vehicles more expensive than they have to be, trying to keep people in locked into yesterday's energy. But I think people are looking toward the future and looking for solutions. And, you know, at a certain point, there's going to be a disconnect between these politicians and opinion hosts who, you know, will go on a segment or a program like that, trying to get everybody to think that, you know, an electric vehicle in this country starts at $66,000 when, you know, those same viewers are going to watch the commercials during the commercial breaks and see what the prices are. And now, what they won't see is that we're fighting to get those prices lower, unless somebody like me is out there to talk about this. That's part of why, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act is going to benefit so many Americans. We're the ones fighting to make EVs cheaper, because we know if we make them more affordable for more Americans, then more Americans can save at the pump. And of course, that's also going to help us build up a U.S.-made EV industry with American jobs, American soil, and American workers, all while helping us to fight climate change. I'm under no illusions that everybody here in Washington is coming to this conversation in good faith. But I'm also under no illusions that people who don't already agree with us are going to have any idea what our message is if we don't go out there and talk about it to anyone who will listen.
Yeah, and I, it's by no means anyone trying to shame you for talking to Fox News or talking to Republicans, because that's part of the job, right? But it seems like you're battling something more than just the economics of this. This feels like a cultural battle as much as anything else. So much of the American myth-making revolves around the open road and the gas-powered engine. You know, those highway videos from the 1950s. Some people are still very much entrenched in that sort of thinking about what kind of country this is. And I wonder how you think you come about that, right? People want to hold on to this past of America that is no longer our present and certainly isn't going to be our future. But how do you get them to let go of what you call, you know, in, I think perhaps euphemistically, the status quo? How do you think about your work in that vein?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember is if we want to be true to a tradition, we got to remember that tradition was about looking to the future. In other words, the best things about our past had to do with getting out of the past. And the worst things about our past are things we don't have to repeat. So when we're thinking about how not just roads, but transportation in general should look going into the 2020s, 30s, 40s, making it work by the 2050s in a whole new way, it's not going to meet the needs of this country to have the mentality of the 1950s. We know better. You know, in some ways we knew better then, but we definitely know better now when it comes to climate, when it comes to how our cities are laid out. Of course, there's a history to it. There's a romance to it. And some of that should be honored. Some of that will always be with us. The open road trips, always going to be an important part of what it is to live in America. But we also need to create more options for people, more opportunities for people, whether you live in a big city or a smaller community, with, for example, making it safer and easier to get around with public transit or on foot on a bike, so that you know, whether you own a car or not, you don't always have to drag 2 tons of metal with you everywhere that you go. This is also an issue of equity. We've got to make sure that we have ways of organizing our infrastructure for the future that don't exclude people, or worse, divide or segregate, something that we've seen a lot of in this country. But there's no reason we have to do it all over again just because that's how things worked in the past.
I wonder politically how this is, you know, how you guys are thinking about this moment, because it's obviously a huge piece of legislation for the president. And we've seen some increasingly positive numbers in the midterm races, or at least in the projections about the midterm races. I think there is a polling out today that has Democrats up by 4%, generally speaking, broadly in the Senate races that are happening this November. We have some Senate seats that look like they could go onto the Democratic side of the ledger. Raphael Warnock could keep his seat. Mark Kelly, John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, Amanda Barnes in Wisconsin. Do you think this plays, does the IRA, does all of this play a role, or is it gas prices? I ask you because you're the transportation secretary and you have to think about gas prices. I mean, how much is this the sort of lofty proposition of a new future vis-a-vis the Biden administration? And how much of this is it just about people saying, oh, my gas is $3 a gallon, not $6?
I think people are looking around at how their lives are different, how they are shaped by forces around the world and political decisions made in Washington. That's one of the reasons gas prices is something that's on everybody's mind. Obviously, you know, gas prices aren't controlled by any individual policymaker in Washington, but they're part of what it's like to live in the American economy, and they hold, you know, Americans hold those in charge responsible for the overall conditions. And you know, to some extent, we've leaned into that. The president took a lot of steps to help stabilize gas prices. Not that, you know, he controls them, but things like releasing the oil from the oil reserve was designed to bring some relief and breathing room and stability. And I think that's contributed to this fall in gas prices. I think what's going to be very important in talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, and for that matter, the bipartisan infrastructure law that we're so excited to be implementing in my department, is not to get so hung up on talking about the legislative mechanism or the finer points of the policy, and really focus on the difference it's actually going to make. I mean, look at the Inflation Reduction Act, for example. You know, part of what that contains is lower prescription drug prices. And most people are on board with that, think we should have done it a long time ago. It really was kind of the American people, the president, and Democratic Senate and House members on one side of this policy issue, Big Pharma and Republican Senate and House members on the other. But that's not how the American people lined up. I saw somewhere, I think something like 70% of Republicans out around the country think it's a good idea to let Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices, even if it got 0% support among Republican members of the House or the Senate when the vote came up. So talking about the specific thing that's going to make a difference in your life, whether it's a more affordable electric vehicle, whether it's more affordable prescription drugs, whether it's the tax credits that are going to help you make your house more energy efficient, save on your energy bills, or the fact that, you know, right now, we are now able to announce improvements to ports, improvements to roads and bridges in neighborhoods around America, a whole new round of grants that we just rolled out that are going to benefit everything from airports to pedestrian crossings that people are feeling. And that's where I think we need to keep the focus.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, I mean, what we're hearing on, for example, Fox News is, pablum about racist highways, which is, you know, in typical Fox fashion, not actually accurate, to be euphemistic, and glosses over what is a really serious issue. You know, we talk about this 1950s Highway Act, and what it did is pave through black and brown neighborhoods and destroyed communities of color. You guys are addressing that in the IRA, and I want to ask a little bit more about that. You've pledged $3 billion to remove some of the highways that the Federal Highway Act built that divided or destroyed those communities. Can you tell us more about what that means and, you know, where you're looking to do this, since so many communities were touched and affected by this?
Yeah, one thing I've noticed is everywhere I go, when I raise this concern that there is often a highway or an interchange or a railway that divides one neighborhood from another, that removed a neighborhood or is even segregating a community, heads nod, and you can just see in people's eyes that they're picturing their community's version of that. This is not something that just happened in the South or just happened in one place or another. We see it everywhere. It happened in Pittsburgh. It happened in St. Paul, Minnesota. It happened in the South as well. Every part happened right here in Washington, D.C. And the point here is not to diminish our ability to get around on roads and highways. It's to connect people where infrastructure is doing the opposite of that, which is dividing. The point of transportation infrastructure is to connect, not to divide. And yet in many places, it is actually connecting some, but dividing others. And the thing that strikes me is, why wouldn't you want us to be dealing with that when we're preparing the vision for the future? Now, there's a lot of different shapes that this can take. In some cases, and again, you're already seeing Atlanta, for example, is working on a project to do just this. Sometimes it's a very intense project where you're going to be capping an entire highway that is running through the heart of a city, putting something over it so that it's connected, and then maybe you have new land that can be used for community use, for park, or for developed. Sometimes it's not going to be as big an intervention as that. It might be more about introducing transit or pedestrian crossings directions to safely get over or under that railroad or highway. The whole point of this initiative is that it's going to look different in different communities. I'm not going to sit at the DOT headquarters and figure out what's right for every community. We're going to invite them to come to us, to apply to us with their ideas on how this funding could help them get better connected. Because again, everywhere I go, you see this as an issue. The very fact that our American English vocabulary includes the phrase wrong side of the tracks, which is, of course, a very racially loaded phrase, too, tells you everything you need to know about how the infrastructure, whose purpose is to connect, can also serve to divide.
Such a poetic and practical point. More connection, less division. Pete Buttigieg, this is why you're the Secretary of Transportation. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Best of luck in your efforts. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
We ran out of time again tonight, so we're going to put out one extra segment that we had planned online at MSNBC.com/Alex Wagner tonight. It's a good one. Check it out.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.